Waiting for the pod.
Sipping for coffee, waiting for the show. Got some iced coffee here.
Oh, nice. It almost looks like that could be a true nutrition
protein shake? Coffee. Doesn't
yeah,
it?
It looks, doesn't it? It could be, yeah, yeah.
No, I do have True Nutrition collagen and True Nutrition creatine monohydrate in there.
Okay.
I've been taking my creatine in the morning since I saw that research, Scott, about it having benefits for a healthier brain.
It's funny because there is some research suggesting that caffeine antagonizes the effects of creatine.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, that was a big thing for years. One of the effects can be that creatine slows muscle relaxation time, and when force is being produced, there's ATP turnover, and when a muscle, let's say it's produced a twitch or it has to relax, you're doing some repetitive motions. Let's say you're doing like a cycling thing, some sort of high intensity bout, and there's a lot of on and off of motor units. The faster you can turn off the muscle when you don't want to have it active, the better, because you're using ATP during that period of relaxation. So okay. If you can minimize that, then you would then have a potential ergogenic effect, because the energy demand would be better. And one of the things that was shown in one of the studies out of Peter Hespel's lab, actually, in Belgium, was that caffeine negated that increase or that faster relaxation that creatine invoked. But then the other thing is that people are like, yeah, that's maybe true, but there were so many of these initial research studies where they literally were giving people creatine exactly the way you're taking it in their coffee. Like, that's what people would do, just mix in their coffee, right?
Yeah.
It would mix in, it dissolves pretty well anyway, but you could put up, you know, a hefty dose in there and warm coffee, no problem. So anyway, that was the big thing, like, because creatine is what I studied for both my master's thesis and my PhD dissertation. So
yeah,
I knew the creatine research really well, and I was following that. Everyone's like, oh no, caffeine, can't have any caffeine with your creatine. And it's like, ah, shit, this sucks. And people were trying to figure out a way around it, but I don't know that it makes that big of a difference, to be honest.
Yeah,
maybe for some people there's something there, but
I wonder if it does have an effect, I'd have a hard time thinking that it would completely make it null and void. You know what I mean?
It seemed to negate that aspect, that potential way in which creatine was acting ergogenically.
Okay.
You know?
I've even seen, like, I know that it's a completely different compound, but I know you're supposed to use T3 on an empty stomach. And I've had times where it's like, hey, I do my best, but I only had, 15 minutes and I needed to eat, you know, and it's like, I still got the effects I wanted. I feel like real world to me sometimes is very different than what I read in studies. I'm like, well, it still worked. I don't know. You know?
Yeah. That interaction with food is highly variable, actually.
So
for some people it can make a big difference, and for others, not so much. And if you also are, you know, eating like you probably were or had been at that time, where it's the same meal each time, then it's probably gonna have the same impact, whatever it might be, large or small for you each time. So you would then just adjust your T3 dose, you know, or whatever.
Right, right. Maybe I need a little bit, you know, you're not seeing the effects you want, then you're gonna increase, right?
A little bit more, yeah. Like with the L-carnitine thing, you know,
right.
I think people were doing that as well, kind of unknowingly. I heard from someone, pretty high level guy that, he removed L-carnitine when he was deep in prep, and he started losing weight really, really quickly.
Oh, really?
L-carnitine blocks the effect at the nucleus. It probably blocks entry of T3 to the nucleus.
Okay.
So, those exact details haven't been elucidated as far as I know, but so when he took the L-carnitine out, this is what we kind of figured out, then the T3 was basically having a stronger effect. And then, as you see, like, all the time, people try to, like, oh shit, I'm not going to be in shape, it's 3 weeks out, I'll just bombard myself with T3, and they drop fat, but they drop muscle really, really quickly too.
Yeah.
So he had sort of inadvertently, like I think a lot of people do, it had he had adjusted his dose of both of those things.
Yeah.
T3 to being at a higher dose to combat the inhibitory effect of L-carnitine. And when he removed the L-carnitine, then the T3 had a stronger effect, and it worked, did not work in his favor.
Yeah.
He dropped weight really, really rapidly because he had, you know, you don't see this in the blood work either. That's the interesting thing. We've talked about this before, but you won't see like a difference in blood work. Because what's going on in the brain in terms of registering TSH and those sorts of things is apparently different than what happens at the target tissues. So the target tissues are affected, but the regulation of the thyroid hormonal axis is not.
Yeah.
So it's really quizzical. We talked about this. That's not what we're going to talk about today, but it just reminded me of that. That was a really interesting. I keep hearing from people after we talked about T3 and L-carnitine, people kind of chime in. It's like, hey, I got a question for you. Someone else that messaged me on Instagram a couple weeks ago, and he's going to mess around with some things to get back to me. So, and these are reputable individuals,
right?
You know, who are
people with
high
a lot
level, IFBB pros who know what they're doing,
are
very scientific, meticulous about what they do. So, anyway, pretty cool.
Hey, I got a quick follow up for you here. What about this one? So, and by the way, guys, we're going to get this thing started. We had a couple questions that Scott was prepared to answer. But if you want to comment with some additional questions, we'll try to tackle those after we get through just a handful of these. So how about this one, Scott? So why would we use L-carnitine then? What would be the benefit? Because it sounds like it's taking everything away.
Yeah. Well, L-carnitine, you can do this orally over the course of, it might take months. Most people inject it, so you get obviously more bioavailability there. And L-carnitine is a component of the acyl transferase that moves acyl or fatty acid movements into the mitochondrion. So what this means is that it will shift your fuel use. This is Stevens et al. You can look up. This is out of Paul Greenhalgh's lab. So Stevens, S-T-P-H-E-N-S. Spelled differently than the first part of my last name. And you basically will shift your fuel use towards fat, right? And that's, you know, that's a great thing. So if you need 2,000 calories a day and you're in a diet, right, and you've got a caloric deficit and you're oxidized, you need that 2,000. You're only taking in 1,500, whatever, so you have a 500 calorie deficit. You want as much of that fuel to come from fat as possible. So if you can shift to, you know, 1,000 calories from fat versus 700, because you've got some carbs and everything coming in there, then that's better. That means you're basically able to oxidize fat better. And for fat loss, that's what most bodybuilders are doing it for. Yeah. It also shifts fuel use during exercise too. They demonstrated this in the Greenhalgh lab experiments too. So that could potentially, I haven't seen a whole lot of follow-up as far as ergogenic effects going, but that could mean, you know, less glycogen use as well. But for someone who's using then cardio to increase fuel use, and you can oxidize more fat during your cardio, then you're basically getting more out of your cardio, so to speak, in terms of fat oxidation. You still have to have that deficit, but overall, if more of the fat oxidized in the deficit that you've already created through cardio in your diet is fat, that's what you want.
Yeah.
So,
I can tell you anecdotally, the one thing I can tell when I'm using L-carnitine is that I sweat a lot more. I sweat a lot more when training. I sweat a lot more during cardio. And I noticed that I get more body odor, Scott. It's something I just figured out in the last couple of years using it from amino. I'd been experimenting with their stuff that goes up to 600 milligrams per milliliter. And I did, in fact, use code THINK there, by the way. But here's the deal is that I noticed I started stinking more, and I was like, man, I just took a shower this morning. I'm a little ripe, you know? And then I take a shower again, and it was an ongoing thing. But for whatever reason, then I came off the L-carnitine and it went away. I was like, oh, maybe my deodorant's not working anymore, you know? But then I came off the L-carnitine, it went away. And then going back on it at another point, the exact same thing happened. And that's when I realized, oh, it was the L-carnitine, in fact.
Or it was something in whatever they have in there.
Oh,
in the L-carnitine. So there could be something else.
I did run the oral as well. So I had gotten the injectable started up. And then I switched to the oral at 2,000 milligrams of the acetyl L-carnitine and N-acetyl. So it continued on. It continued on with that, too. So I really do think it was just L-carnitine for me.
Yeah. It could come out in your sweat. I don't know. You know, it makes its way into lipid membranes, you know, in the mitochondria. So it's, you know, it may very well make its way out in your sweat. Yeah. And then when the bacteria get a hold of it, then you get stinky city.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The thing people mention, like, oh, I'm sweating so much. And I've never seen anything, because I did a pretty deep dive, suggesting that it literally increases your metabolic rate. There's some shift in fuel use there. And you get, when you're oxidizing purely fat, you only, and relative to your oxygen consumption, you don't quite get as much energy out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense that would happen, that you'd see an elevation of metabolic rate to some degree, and that you become, in a sense, for any given energy expenditure during cardio, or you even, obviously, things that ultimately end up being aerobic in the long haul, you do have anaerobic exercise, but you've got an oxygen debt that needs to be repaid, et cetera. You would incur an inefficiency to some degree during exercise.
Yeah.
It sounds like people are saying, like, you know, I'm hardly sweating, and then when I get on L-carnitine, I'm just this sweaty mess.
Right.
And that seems like that's a much stronger effect than what this, what would it be? It'd be about a 6% inefficiency, something like that. It's not a huge deal.
Okay.
So anyway, that's interesting. Oh, 12% inefficiency. So I don't know what's going on there with all the sweating, but it, you know, could be a multitude of things, but I've never seen that document even as a side effect in some of the studies, but obviously I hear it all the time. Right.
Right. Right.
It's one of those things everyone says, right. That's how I know it's real, is because it's sweating.
Yeah.
You know? So that's interesting.
We have,
I've looked, and I hope I can figure that out.
Prank says Stinky Scott and Smart Scott.
Oh, nice. Regular Scott is what someone said. And one of the other things, regular Scott, how about just Mr. Scott? You can use Mr.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thank you for tuning in to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. And guys, you can get Scott's book over at byobbcoach.com. A lot of the stuff we talk about is all cataloged through the book. It'll literally take you from your off-season planning, through your off-season, through your prep, to the stage, and literally the day of the show covers everything, and then beyond that too. Go to TrueNutrition.com and use our code THINK over there for high quality supplements like my creatine that I just drank and my collagen. Use our code THINK, like I said, get some savings and support us. Thank you to everybody, by the way, from Patreon. We had a couple opening questions from Patreon. Scott, is there anything you wanted to jump into right away? I titled this show, the guy that we had, one guy who was talking about getting a better mind-muscle connection. Did you have anything for that one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I figured you said, hey, that's what I'm calling the show. I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to have to answer that. You didn't give me much choice.
We don't have to go deep into it, but...
it's a really good question, actually. Yeah. I like it.
Marky Mark said over at Patreon, he says, I'd like to know if Scott has any out-of-the-box suggestions for improving the mind-muscle connection for troublesome body parts. In my case, that would be my triceps, especially the long head. This was further compounded by acute C6, C7 nerve pinch in 2014 that left my tricep, forearm, pinky finger of my dominant arm very weak. I used neck traction. Let's see, what else did he do? He's used lion's mane regularly, and he feels that things have improved. It's a long answer. So, but triceps are still clearly lagging. Never get a pump, and always feels weak with very low muscle endurance. Mm-hmm. So he threw out some different thoughts about possibly like doing E-stim, BPC 157, TB 500. Would that possibly help? He says it's been 10 years. And he's wondering if maybe the ship has sailed. But are there any suggestions to basically hack the nervous system? Are much appreciated.
Yeah, he might go. The first thing it might be, because it's still going on, just to see exactly what the diagnosis would be now. Like it's the C8 nerve root. So the nerve root that exits under the C7 vertebra, it goes to the pinky. So he's probably got some C8 involvement, I would guess, just academically speaking, not diagnostically speaking.
Yeah.
see what's going on there. It might be, I have a Saunders unit. It's sitting over here. I had one for my neck that I haven't used in years, but because I haven't needed it. But if he sees a PT, it might be worth, because those are pricey. Those are prescription only devices. So he might be able to get the PT to tell him whether or not that's a good idea to continue doing that. It might be helpful, you know, just if he's got, because things are probably only going to get worse. If he's got degenerative disc disease in his neck, and things are going to shorten down, he's going to get more impingement there. An e-stim unit could be really cool. A PT could do that if that's his or her druthers during the PT session. And it could also be used for biofeedback. So let's say, from what I picked up from reading this, it's really the long head on his one arm, his dominant arm. That's the main issue. So you could put e-stim on that, and that's going to do a couple of things. One, it could be a biofeedback mechanism. So he knows what it feels like to do that, and that could help train his nervous system to then activate that muscle.
Okay.
It's also gonna train that muscle back to some degree, so that muscle could be rehabbed. This could even be something because you want to be careful with e-stim. Turn that on while you're exercising. So he could. There's all tons of e-stim units that are out there, and some of them you probably could get a prescription for, but some of them are really powerful, and you can only use them with the PT's assistance. But you could activate that during training of the triceps. And that would then could bring that muscle back, at least in terms of size. How long that would stay if he didn't continue the e-stim is going to be a function of, you know, how intact his nervous system is. The thing that's nice about using e-stim is so you put pads on the muscle and you depolarize those neurons that goes to those motor units, those fibers of those motor units. And the depolarization wave, of course, goes down to the muscle, causes the contraction, but also goes back up to the spinal cord. So there's an antidromic depolarization wave that goes back. So if there are neurons there that aren't easily activated because he's got some compression, but they're still alive, they still exist, those then could be activated. So he wouldn't even just be rehabbing the muscle fibers, but he could be rehabbing the neurons themselves and bringing them back to life, so that then they're more readily activated. Which would help, of course, if he does have compression, use the Saunders machine. So you get sort of basically bring back all the pieces of the neuromuscular system associated with that tricep. So you got to get the muscle working and to get the nerves working. And then you want to fix the root of the problem, which would be potentially the issue in his neck. Yeah. But that's for, you know, the PT to figure out. So the long head is a biarticulate muscle. It crosses the shoulder. So it does extension and basically adduction. So back down, like you feel it on like a pull down, you activate the long head pretty hard. And then extension too. So the way that I found that people can train that, if it's a weak spot, is to ensure that there is either an adduction vector or an abduction vector that you have to fight with adduction, or there's a shoulder flexion vector that you have to fight with shoulder extension. So for instance, if you're doing like a tricep press down, typically you'd be standing on the cables right here, right? And pressing straight down. If you step back so that the cable is more in front of you, the pulley is more in front of you, and it's pulling you in this direction, you then have to extend the shoulder in order to keep your elbows tucked in tight.
Yeah.
So now that's going to activate that long head. If you're going to have to, and even to do that movement, you're going to have to activate it. What that may mean, especially for him, especially on that one side, is that he's not going to be able to use nearly as much weight. But it's going to ensure activation just to keep the elbows at your side of that long head. You can do the same thing, old school movement. You don't see people doing very often. Do an overhead triceps extension, kneeling with your elbows on a bench in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of a pain in the ass sometimes, you don't have a long cable, but the cable's back behind your head and you're leaning with your head on a bench or the bench right there in front of you. So you're literally on the ground with the bench on the floor in front of you, and you hold your elbows down and you do extensions like that.
Yeah.
And that of course has this vector pulling you this direction. And now you've also got some stretch on the long head, could potentially accentuate the stimulus for it. what else did I put in here for that? A couple other ideas. You can use overhead tricep press downs as well, or, you know, where you've got, you typically, unless the cable's right behind you, you're still going to have that pull. So you're going to have to use the tricep, the long head, to extend. PJR pullovers, a lost exercise that works really, really well, is another one he could do. So that just involves some elbow extension during the concentric. And then he could also take, and this will be, it's kind of hard to describe. I'm going to move back a little bit, but if you do a nice tricep movement, is to do a cable crossover where the cable's across like this, right? So you've got some abduction, or so you got sort of some extension and activation of the long head where you're doing this. You can do them out here like this, right? So you're doing a horizontal abduction. And you could do it if the cable's at the right angle, you can do sort of a 45 degree like that, right?
Yep.
So he's not just got triceps extension. He's also got some movement at the shoulder. Yep. And the trick for him would be to find the right angle where he can most activate that long head. And during all of these, especially with the unilateral ones, which are nice, he's going to expect to have weakness on that one side. So some of this training is going to be limited by how much he can do with the weak side, the dominant. Yeah. Dominant side, the affected side. So, but the more weakness, the more asymmetry he sees, the more of a deficit he sees, probably the more he's targeting what he's wanting to do, right? So he's got a decade now of accommodating. He probably does his pressing like all wonky, you know, so that he can effectively, it's a neuromuscular activation strategy so that he can use his triceps, maybe use his anterior delt more on pressing, or he's changing his act. He's probably asymmetric on a lot of things, unless he really focuses on not being. So he's going to want to find those things that where he's got this maximal kind of deficit, and then stick with those and just let the strong arm, you know, it'll have no problem doing those reps. Whereas the weak arm is the one he wants to train. So, and he could do that with a PT too. A good PT could show him these things, and with the E-stim on top of it. Right.
Yeah.
The other thing he could do as well is pre-fatigue. If he can just jack his arm back and extend his tricep once he gets good, or even, you know, how people, when you do before you hit a lat spread, you put your hands on your hips and you drive back and pull your lats into contraction. Mm-hmm. That also activates that long head of the triceps. You see it really clearly on people that have the big triceps.
Yeah.
You could just do that. Practice that, hold that for a while, and then go into those movements.
Yeah.
So he's developing that mind-muscle connection and carrying it into the movement. So it's hard. This is online, a podcast. This is the type of stuff that a good PT, a good personal trainer.
Being able to see it and feel it in the gym.
You can see it and feel it, yeah.
Yeah.
And using a mirror can be helpful too, because, you know, he's so used to this.
Right.
So many people have all this accommodation that happens when they have shoulder injuries or hip injuries or whatever, and they're doing all sorts of things asymmetrically, and they don't even recognize it, right? It's because that's how they've been doing it. So if you look at yourself in the mirror, you're like, holy shit, I got this shoulder's all jacked up, you know?
Right.
You have to go with light weights and slowly. So this is going to the mind-muscle connection literature that we have. There's studies where a lot of the classic, I've talked about this before, is you tell people to use their chest on a bench press, you tell them to use a tricep on a bench press. And people can do that pretty well when the weight is light or when they're not asked to do a ballistic contraction. Hmm. So when you go heavy, you get closer to your one rep max, you're not going to be able to do a bench press just with a focus, use EMG to basically figure out whether someone actually is activating the chest more so when they're asked to use the chest. Or they're doing a better job of acting the triceps when they're asked to make this a tricep press.
Yeah.
You can't do that when the weight gets too heavy. And you have to activate more motor units to move a weight faster. So once it gets too strenuous in terms of weight or trying to be explosive, you lose that ability to have a mind-muscle connection and make an exercise that where you have triceps and anterior delts and chest to choose from in this case. So you got to go slow and you have to use a lighter weight. So it's okay for him to use lighter weights and do sets of 20 and 30. And then literally a good practice, just you know, perfect practice basically is important, is do those tricep extensions, which everyone sees doing, and do them until he starts to loop, as long as he's getting some good mind-muscle connection. Once he starts to feel like, okay, I'm not hitting the long head of the triceps the way I want to, I'm starting to lose that connection, then you're done, right?
Yeah.
He's finished, because then he's got it. Then he's practicing another activation pattern. He wants to sort. He's trying to retrain his nervous system, and this could take, you know, years to do. But first thing is go see somebody and get to the root of the problem and see, you know, if, what's going on with his neck. They could do a nerve conduction study, see which nerve roots are actually involved. Whatever the Western medical professionals think is appropriate, and then he can see maybe he's just pissing in the wind, you know, trying to do all this stuff. If his neck is so jacked up. You know, you're dealing with a faulty system, and you gotta fix the system first.
Yeah. We got a bunch of stuff on the live stream, so I'm going to jump into one of those. Vince says, first of all, he said, Scott has been an incredible resource. He's always been incredibly helpful, thorough, I guess he's trying to say, with answers. And he's got a question for us too. You remember, Scott, when you were doing high protein for a contest prep? Now, this is, he says way back in the day or back in the day. I feel like this was just a couple of years ago as far as my mind remembers it.
Yeah.
But he says,
you're an old guy though, like me. So.
Yeah, that must be what it is. He says, could you have Scott go over what his 500 grams of protein per day pre-contest diet looked like? And if there's anything about that approach that he'd change. So 500 grams of protein, what does that mean? Like, how does that look, say, per meal? What would be a standard meal to get in 500 grams of protein per day?
I mean, that's 500 gram protein meals. That's basically a really, really, really high. I mean, there are guys that go 500 grams of protein in their off season.
Yeah.
Right. And if you just take everything out, you end up at 500 grams, right? And that's 2,000 calories a day.
Okay.
You know? So that can be a deficit. If someone, I don't know what, remember what I was weighing at that point in time. I don't remember if exactly 500 grams. I think there were days I was doing 500 grams.
Okay.
But that was when I think I was taking a lot of casein too. Vince asked me this question on Instagram. So I mentioned, you know, these could be good questions for the podcast. So here he is asking this question.
Yeah.
So The thing about, just kind of address the high protein idea in general. So when you diet down, the literature suggests there is an advantage to having higher proteins. Even a study suggests greater fat loss with a higher protein intake, thermogenic effect, what have you. More protein is going to help with your appetite. So when you take in that much protein, my appetite is minimal. As long as you can kind of stick to that, right?
Yeah.
So that can be pretty bland and nasty. You can get to where you're producing. I think when I'd get done training and I was oxidizing so much protein, the urea coming out my sweat. There are a couple times I left my clothes in my gym bag.
And you get like that really gross ammonia type
stuff. Oh, awful. Like, it's sometimes it's bad, you know, that's just a normal thing when you're taking a high protein diet, but this was just atrocious. It was really bad. Like, I think I'm going to have to throw away this whole bag.
Oh, God.
In there. Yeah. And I would even take, like, little grocery store plastic bags to throw my sweaty stuff in. And I'm like, this was like radioactive. It seeped right through the plastic and into everything. You know, it was really, really bad.
Yeah.
So I'm not suggesting anyone do this. What I do is just kind of mess around with things and take them to their extremes, just to get a sense of what that would look like. Within reason, of course. I'm not trying to use any crazy pharmaceuticals or what have you that I know to be dangerous, just to see like what would happen to my kidneys,
right?
Something like that. But that is an approach. You can run into really high urea issues, you know, that your kidneys will have a problem with eventually. You don't want to do that. You'll stink, right? So, but that was a high, and I was a big competitor. Heavyweight, you know, top of the heavyweights, 215, 220, I think, when I was doing that. So it wasn't like I was a 150-pound person. It wasn't a bikini competitor.
Right.
Trying to take in that much protein. But more protein can be helpful for those reasons. And that's the one thing, you know, that has an anti-catabolic effect, actually has an anabolic effect too, of course.
Yeah.
And when you're in a catabolic condition, protein is the most anabolic nutrient you can take in because you've got a caloric deficit there. Yeah. So that was basically the strategy, just to see what happened. And my appetite was like minimal.
I can only imagine. It'd be a tough diet. But you did have, I assume, veggies with it too?
No, I didn't think I had much veggies.
Really? So what did you do for fiber?
I would add Benefiber to my shakes.
Yeah.
So, because that mixes in like nothing. You can't even tell that it's there.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think. See, I have some of this written down, but uh-huh. I used to write everything down meticulously like decades ago.
Yeah.
And now I've just gone by feel for so many years, you know?
Yeah.
When I was intentionally trying something outside of my normal box, okay, we're going to just go with protein here. See what happens. You can do proteins. Go ahead.
One of the things I was going to say is I found that for people that don't tolerate a lot of carbs, don't tolerate a lot of fats, that protein is a lot less likely to make you fat. You know what I mean? If you can go with high proteins for somebody who's really sensitive, and in certain cases, I found that that can work really well for somebody who maybe struggles with a diet that has a lot of carbs or fats in them.
Yeah, you don't like when, and you know, this is Jose Antonio's work I'm mainly thinking of, is when you add like 1,000 calories a day compared to a control group from protein.
Yeah.
Doesn't do anything much for muscle mass, at least in his work, but it also didn't increase body fat.
Yeah, yeah.
You won't like, if you're in an excess, adding protein. Now, this might be different if you're, you know, at 6,000 calories and you go to 8,000 calories or something like that.
Right.
Right. Or 7,000 calories, you add, you know, 250 grams of protein. But that's extreme situations. And someone who's already doing that, they're probably on so much gear that probably wouldn't matter. You've got a totally different scenario. That would be, almost no one would do that. So that's just hypothetically speaking. But protein is a safe thing to add in. The problem can be if you're trying to add calories, if you're in an off-season situation, you add more protein, then that can inhibit your appetite. It makes it more difficult to eat things.
Yeah.
And if you've already got a lot of calories in there, the protein can cause some digestive issues because it's almost all digested and absorbed, right? It's not as if all of a sudden you're just pooping out protein. But when you have so much in there, you know, that 3% that doesn't get absorbed, you know, that's now become 6%, and you may have, you know, doubled what the bacteria in your gut are getting, and then you can cause GI issues.
Yeah.
And you're just pushing way outside the norm of a normal diet anyway.
What about this one from Jim over at Patreon? He says, does the timing of an AI or finasteride matter in relation to the timing of when you take your test?
So, yeah, pharmacokinetics, you know, makes a difference, obviously. What kind of test are we talking about? And what AI are we talking about? So if you have done a good job of, based on whatever of those compounds you're using, taking them at a regular frequency so that you don't have big highs and lows in the blood levels of any of those things, then you're probably in good shape.
Yeah.
You don't have an issue, right? But if you're like someone who's, for instance, been prescribed to take your testosterone enanthate, I forget you're up in Michigan, man.
Oh, yeah.
You just mold, had snow. Yeah, like,
we just had snow, man.
Yeah.
Do you have something metal in your hands, by the way?
Oh, I do. Sorry, yeah.
Yes, I keep hearing it. Yes, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, they're two dog tags. I changed my dog tags out with my new address on them, so these are just sitting here. I'm going to file them away with all the dog tags I have over the years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, this microphone works, man. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it picks up like all the little condenser mics. They pick up all the little sounds, you know. They get the roundness and the richness of your voice, too.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, you can have, if a doc prescribes you, like, come in and do your test shot once a week, you know, so you get these high levels 24, 48 hours later, and you're like, you know, you're down to your hypogonadal, you know, by the time you come in. And then you're doing like your AI. I can even seen anastrozole prescribed like once a week, 1 milligram, something like that.
Okay.
And you can run into problems then, right? So now you've just got havoc. Shit's all over the place.
Yeah.
But if you're spreading things out, it's not a problem. But yeah, you could create a scenario, you know, where, you know, you try to maximally distort your testosterone to estrogen ratio by timing things relative to their peaks, depending on what you're using, so that you don't have steady states of anything, and then you could skew stuff all over the place.
Okay.
But if you're, you know, if you're being smart about it, it shouldn't be a problem, I don't think. But it can vary. Yeah. So you have to, you know, that can happen. People do all sorts of, people just like, oh, they get used to doing something one certain way. And then they just forget that something else changed. The next thing you know, it's like, wow, I feel really good on Thursday and Friday. And I feel like crap on Sunday and Monday. It's like, okay, let's look at what you're doing. You know,
yeah.
See how these things are timing. It's like, ah, this is why you ran out of this. So you started taking it once a week,
yeah.
You know, cause you wanted to, and then you got some more and you just kept taking it once a week when you should have been taking it twice a week or three times a week. And then you switch this, that, and the other. Next thing you know, it's like, okay, yeah, you've ended up with kind of a screw situation in terms of the pharmacokinetics.
I feel like this could be more of a problem with AI than with the finasteride timing, at least. I feel like with finasteride, mm-hmm. it's just a matter of continually keeping it in your system, you know, taking mm-hmm. it day after day after day, whether it be oral or topical. But for sure, the AI, I've always gone with the next day. In a lot of cases, if we need an AI, I've waited 12 to 24 hours, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've been told, at least, is a good time on average to use an AI if you're going to use one. I don't know if you've heard anything similar.
Yeah, I mean, there's different half-lives too. It depends on which AI you're talking about. So that's
okay.
You know, that's some part of it. And this varies per person too. So like anastrozole is shorter than exemestane, which is shorter than letrozole, right?
Okay.
Letrozole is short as well. Letrozole is the shortest of them.
Shortest.
I mixed that up. Anastrozole is short. Letrozole is long.
Yeah.
Long letrozole. Yeah. And exemestane is pretty short, like a day. So exemestane makes sense. That's the one I think is smartest in terms of blood lipids.
Okay.
So that would be one. Yeah. If you're going to expect your testosterone, like an enanthate or cypionate, to peak 24 to 40 hours later, exemestane the next day would make sense. So you're sort of matching the exemestane levels with the testosterone levels.
Yeah.
But if you got another one, and let's say you're not doing your testosterone once a week, right? So you don't have to worry about peaks and lows. Then you don't have to worry about it. But that would be one way to do it. Yeah. The thing would be then, let's say you're taking your exemestane twice a week. You're
okay.
testosterone only once a week. Well, you probably should, if you're going to couple them that way, you should probably make sure that you've got the same dosing frequency for both of those compounds, your AI and your test.
Yeah.
So your test would be the need to be three times a week and exemestane three times a week. And your dose, of course, you know, adjusted so you have the right weekly dose you're looking for. So, but with letrozole, it wouldn't matter so much, right?
Yeah.
So it depends on which one you're using. Not that letrozole is the best to go with, but, you know, yes, it's so strong, but smaller doses, you know, could also be employed.
Right. Hey, Kane said over back when I mentioned your book, Kane said that Vigorous Steve just plugged Scott's book today in his video as well. That's cool.
Yeah, he said he was going to do that. So
that's nice.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. That's cool of him.
All right. What else do we have here? Guys, keep commenting with questions. We'll be happy to take them. And over here on Patreon, we had some more capsaicin for metabolism growth recovery. This is from Adrian over on Patreon. This is completely out of my wheelhouse. I'm not very familiar with what capsaicin does besides being used as like a muscle rub.
Yeah. I mean, it has some actions centrally in the brain that would have thermogenic effects. But he's talking about everything, right? Like, what do you say? Recovery,
metabolism, growth, and recovery.
Metabolism, yes, it's got some potential thermogenic actions. It's used in several supplements now. It's not extraordinary; it hasn't taken off extraordinarily well, but it does definitely have some effects there. Anything that's going to increase your metabolism then could potentially have a negative effect on growth, potentially. But I haven't seen I don't know if anyone is using it on a regular basis in high doses. It'd be like taking a fat burner when you're trying to gain muscle mass, right?
Yeah.
You're kind of shooting yourself in the foot to some degree, right? You want to have a metabolism that's robust. And everyone's going to potentially vary in this way. You know, there's this idea like you would take T3 during your off season to keep your metabolism running, so to speak, and increase protein synthesis as well to bolster what you're getting from whatever else you're using to increase protein synthesis, right? So to sort of jack that up. But if you're using a thermogenic that's elevating your metabolic rate, that means you're going to have to eat more.
Yeah.
So you run into a potential conundrum. It's just me would be just spitting in the wind to try to say whether it could or couldn't help.
Okay.
If you do more cardio to expend more energy, right, and then you eat more on top of that, you know, and you've done the cardio in a way that doesn't interfere with your with muscle growth, then do you have a greater overall effect because you've got the catabolic effect of cardio, but you have to eat more, and then you're eating more food, and then you have more anabolism. You come out ahead. Some people find that they do better that way. They feel better. They've got, in this case with the cardio, you've got the training effect too that could make it easier for you to train hard in the gym because you're more cardiovascularly fit. So there's that thing with the thermogenic. Let's say you have to eat to counteract the thermogenic effect of capsaicin. You eat more food, have more anabolic effect. But that's just kind of all, pardon my French, is kind of theoretical bullshit. So I would save the fat burners, those things that are thermogenic for when you're focused on thermogenesis. Unless you're someone who, for whatever reason, like just gains tons of fat in the off season, you have a hell of a time taking it off. For instance, like an example of that would be people who put on a lot of lower body fat. I've talked about women sometimes who would take yohimbine during the off season to try to stave off the lower body fat accumulation. So, you know, if you're someone who needs to gain, you gain really easily, and you want to keep your food at a reasonable level, and you do cardio to allow you to eat more food, and putting on the muscle isn't a problem, it's the fat that you're worried about, then a thermogenic might make sense, something like capsaicin, if that is something that would work for you. Yeah. So there's a rationale for some people. If you're a guy who, you know, is skinny as a bean and can't gain to save his life, you don't want to, and your body fat never gets above 9% anyhow, you don't want to have capsaicin in there, I wouldn't think.
Yeah.
You don't want anything speeding up your metabolism.
That makes sense. What about Casey has one for us, and he says, and by the way, comment from, I just like this guy's name, Chuck E. Cheese Ranch. He says, what's up, guys? Love the deep dives into the science. I like that. Chuck E. Cheese Ranch. Okay, so Casey had one for us. He says, Ed Cohen episode came to mind. There are correlations between neck, wrist, ankle circumference, and the back to front torso thickness of elite powerlifters like Ed. How does this affect how the load is dispersed?
I read that question and I understand the first part, right? That there's, when you look at the anthropometric measurements, they correlate. Okay. People who have bigger rib cages have bigger wrists, right? You see a more robust somatotype, so to speak, or a more robust skeletal structure that is more uniform throughout. You don't see someone with gigantic wrists and then they have, small neck, something like that. Those things sort of all increase or change in parallel. But the last part of the question, can you read that again? This is what I'm not sure where he's going with what he's.
Well, he's with us here. So Casey, if you could restate that for us, we'll come back to it. We'll see what he says to restate that. Cause he's asking like, how is that load? He says, how does this affect how the load is dissipated? So I'm not sure exactly what he means by that. So we'll let him get back to us. Guy taking Seroquel to help him fall asleep. Does all the sleep hygiene advices, he's done all the sleep hygiene advice as well. Does Scott have any opinions on any negative effect on bodybuilding? So using a medication like Seroquel, which is a strong medication. I know they're using it more I believe it's even used with like schizophrenic patients, but I know it's used off label. Yeah, used off label to help with sleep. What are your thoughts there?
It shifts. I just looked into this briefly. Most sleep medications will change your sleep architecture. In this case, it seems like it reduces REM a little bit.
Okay.
So, you know, you want to make sure you're getting adequate sleep. My thought is, like, he says he's doing all the sleep hygiene things, is still something's not in place.
Hmm.
There's some reason why he's not able to sleep. So I would go back to look at that. This is the acupuncturist in me. It's like, what's the root of this problem here?
Yeah.
Why isn't he able to sleep? Is he using stims? Maybe it comes back from, I'm not saying he does or doesn't, but some people are like, I had a long day, so I take a pre-workout before I work out right after work.
Yeah, 7 at night.
Yeah, I was like, okay, I wonder why you can't sleep. 500 milligrams of caffeine in your pre-workout, something like that. So I look at that first. It also has an antihistamine effect.
Oh.
And antihistamines, I've just seen this has been something that's been substantiated, I think, more lately, can potentially have an impact on cognitive function, in particular dementia, your likelihood of having dementia, or the how early in your life you'll have dementia, so the onset of dementia.
Okay.
So this is just sort of cross-sectional epidemiological work. People who use those, not just for sleep, but in general, tend to have issues with dementia. So he can look into that. That'd be something that, you know, it's not going to affect his bodybuilding, because that's going to be, you know, decades later, probably, when bodybuilding is way in the background.
Yeah.
But that's something to consider, like a long-term side effect. But if he feels, I mean, strictly speaking, like, if he can't sleep and he can't figure it out, that's going to affect your bodybuilding. If he takes the Seroquel and he can sleep better and he's more recovered, that's going to help his bodybuilding.
Yeah.
But in the long haul, it'd be nice to figure out why. For instance, you know, if he does diet down to get on stage, was he just going to take more Seroquel? Maybe, you know, gets really hard to sleep when you're dieting down, you know? So do you want to do that? How much do you want to take? I don't know much about that medication, to be honest. I mean, I just knew that it's out there, but those are pretty strong meds too. So, so there's all sorts of, like, the True Nutrition sleep aid is it works pretty well for lots of people.
I haven't used it. I have to check it out.
Yeah. I mean, that would be something that, you know, he might look into. Nothing is, you know, side effect free, but that might be worth checking into.
Yeah. I did a show a long time ago with Dr. Dean St. Mart, and he talked a lot about the supplements that would help you to improve your sleep quality versus leaning into supplements that would band-aid it and just cause you to get tired, you know, or knock you out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's not a fan of using melatonin to help with sleep, for instance. He's more of a fan of putting your body in a position to create more melatonin. You know, that's kind of what his thought process is.
Mm-hmm.
You looking something up there, Scott?
I was, but that's all good. I was looking at my notes here to see if I had anything else on that.
All right. He doesn't use any caffeine. Let's see. This guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, wait. It's a different guy here. He's in the live stream. He says, no matter what I use, I don't know what this is, this medication. Oh, it's Remeron?
Yeah.
Super low dose for sleep. And he says he also doesn't use caffeine after 3 p.m.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, I'm big on, whenever possible, figure out what's going on. You know, I think in the long haul, like, I mean, you could have something that's really some life situation that's keeping you awake.
Yeah.
And in the long haul, like, let's say you solved that, you figure that out. It's like, you know, I need to talk to my ex, or I need to talk to my parent, or I need to talk to someone, whatever it is, and solve that and get that out of my head. Or I need to go do therapy, you know, the bigger picture, and then I can sleep. And I'd rather do that than use a patch, you know, use a Band-Aid to help someone sleep. So, bodybuilding and PEDs, they're things that can be used, I think, to help people actualize if they've got everything else in place in their life. It's like, you know, it's like adding to, I've got a car that I've built. I'm kicking ass and taking names, and I want to see how fast I can go. I'm
gonna
do this. But if you have a flat in your tire, right? And so the thing's, you know, flopping around and you can't drive on the road. My thought would be, hey, stop and change the tire, get a new tire, or fix the tire, what have you, as opposed to, you know, what, how can we patch that up? Now, in the short term, you know, you're 6 weeks out from a show, you got to figure out how to sleep. You've got this, so you broke up with your girlfriend 2 weeks beforehand, right? You want to sleep, you want to get ready to get on stage. Yeah, you patch the tire up. You're in the middle of your race, right? But in the long haul, change the tire, you know, let's change the tire if at all possible. And then you being the car are in a better place overall for whatever else you want to tackle in life. You know, because those things that manifest in inability to sleep are probably things that are manifesting elsewhere in your life, psychologically or otherwise, that maybe you're not aware of. This has been my experience.
Yeah.
And then, you know, working with people too. Yeah. Is, you know, let's get to the root of the problem.
So Casey's back and he said, load is dissipated better. Okay. Nobody in top lifters is, he says, pancaked out. Not in the gear sense. Nobody is very flat back to front. Not from muscle, but from having a bigger rib cage in hips. Ed Cohen, being the goat of powerlifting, is built like a mailbox. I still don't understand what you're trying to say, man. I don't understand what's the question. Yeah, he's a thick guy.
I think he just answered the question.
Okay.
I think he just gave the answer. The load is dissipated better.
Better.
I think, does he mean distributed better? Dissipated, because dissipate means just kind of dissolve away.
Yeah.
Right? Like it sort of vanishes. I think he means distributed better, or I'm not sure. I don't know how to answer that because I don't get the question. Then I'm not sure how to look at it even from a scientific. I'm not a biomechanist, so this sounds like it could be a biomechanics question.
Yeah. Let's see what else do we have here. Let's see if we have anything in the Patreon. Okay, so how about this one? Manufacturer's recommendations of a vial of quick pen of Humalog is that we should dispose of it within 28 days after opening, even if there is insulin left. Is that actually required, or is it similar to 10 milliliter vials of test, where the manufacturers recommend disposing of it after 28 days, but we regularly go beyond that without issue? I wasn't sure if the temperature requirements of insulin make a difference. Thanks, Dr. Scott and regular Scott.
That was the regular Scott comment. Yeah. I didn't know. Have you seen that a 10 mil vial of test should be used up in a month?
Never heard of that before. Cause I've gotten a 10 milliliter vial of test that's meant to be, you know, my next, 10 doses or so.
10 weeks. Right. So that's longer than 28 days. So I haven't seen that before. I did find a couple papers. You can look them up. Richter, Richter.
Yeah.
It's a review from 2023, thermal stability and storage of insulin.
Yeah.
It says they just say once open, a vial or cartridge could be stored at ambient temperature, so room temperature, used for approximately 4 to 6 weeks. The problem is the contents of the cartridge are no longer sterile.
Yeah.
So like, even if you're using like a quick pen or what have you, technically you've punctured, you know, you've ejected it out during the injection. But there's some possibility that you could get bacteria in there, and that's the idea. So that would be one of the reasons why, 28 days of opening, because you're running into, they say 4 to 6 weeks. So 28 days would be 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Putting on the safe side, right? At room temperature, insulin does really, really well.
Really?
I forgot I had this because I've looked into this. Let me see. Where are you here? I'm going to send you a picture real quick if we can put it up, Scott.
Sure. Tanya Miller says that that's what my prescription bottles all say, mine included. Mine actually says 21 days. So I wonder, are these oil-based products? Are they water-based?
Interesting. doesn't make much sense given the nature of the prescription.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that with a water-based insulin. But that said, I mean, I'm going to tell you right now, though, before we get into the paper here you've got, Scott, the study you have here, or this chart. But in real life, I don't know many bodybuilders that get rid of that insulin vial after 28 days.
Yeah. And most people keep it in the fridge, too, and that's going to help.
Yeah.
So this is, as it says there, this is the paper is cited there from 2020. You might want to make it bigger. It depends on what people are looking on their phone. But what they did was they looked at the units per milliliter, so the concentration okay. over the course of, I'm trying to think, 86 days. I pulled this up like just like a month ago, I think, whenever he first sent me this, so over 2 weeks ago, I guess. And basically at 37 degrees Celsius, which is body temperature, all the way down to 4 degrees Celsius, which might be your fridge, if you look at all these versions of insulin down the mean columns, the percentages are all, you know, above 90. I think the lowest I see is like 97.7. So basically, yeah, there's zero breakdown of insulin, huh, over the course of
86 days.
Measurements 86 days, 15 time points for 86 days. So insulin does really, really well at room temperature, 22 degrees Celsius, body temperature even, or in the fridge. It holds up really well. And I've heard people finding like a vial of insulin like in their desk, you know,
yeah,
like years later. It's like, shit, I didn't know that was in there. Like, why did I put that there?
Yeah.
And it was still good. It was still fine. So
I have a client who's type 1 and he leaves his in his nightstand. He's just got a drawer. Yeah. He just keeps it there. And, yeah, you know, and he's checking, obviously, his blood sugar, and he needs this stuff to survive. And it's still working for him.
Yeah. So I think, I know that's interesting that Tanya said that, too. So that must be like a cover your butt situation, that there's some risk of bacterial infection. It's funny how this is a whole other topic, but if that is what that is, that the legal system is basically injecting, pardon the pun, illogical statements into our medical system. It's like, here's your 10-week supply of insulin. Use this up within 28 days.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, well, okay. Yeah. What do you want me to, like, why don't you give me a volume or an amount that would fit within the expiration date, the quote unquote expiration date of the prescription you've given me? That makes zero sense. So that's probably just, there's probably maybe something, I have to look that up. That's interesting. I'll try to remember to check into that, because that's the only reason I could think of why that would do that, is that you might have, there is a risk, of course, you know, especially oil. You've got it. Something could be growing in there.
Well, you know? Well, oil is going to be more sterile than water, right?
Oh yeah. Right. Right. But still with oil, the water, that's the thing. The insulin is 4 to 6 weeks, and the oil would be even better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, with those, it's interesting. You've got a bigger gauge needle. You've got larger, well, it depends on the person. Trying to think, there's dosing is different with testosterone and oil versus a smaller amount of insulin.
That's true.
Yeah, so like, you know, the possibility of bacteria getting in there could be different. Sometimes, like the rubber on those vials, because you've got benzobenzoate in there and benzyl alcohol.
Oh yeah.
Like that can have an effect on how easily bacteria could get in. So that could be something that's going to vary, as opposed to, you know, insulin, which doesn't have, I don't remember everything that's in there, but I think it doesn't have quite the caustic chemicals in there. Yeah. So you don't have a problem. Like, you let, you know, a vial of testosterone enanthate sit around for a couple of years, and that rubber stopper could be pretty fucking bad. Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And insulin, no, it won't. That won't happen. So that might be part of the reason why you could get bacteria in there more quickly.
I've used gear that had sat for a really long time. Mm-hmm. I had a couple bottles of liquid Depol that now were unopened. So they were unopened. It had never been punctured once. But we're talking like expired in 2018. meaning, uh-huh. you know, that, and it was a UGL. So they put like a 3-year, 2-year on it or whatever. So that means mm-hmm. I probably bought it in like 2015 and I just used it within the last year. So, and it was still good. No problems with it, you know?
I'm sure. Yeah. I wouldn't imagine that would degrade either. But yeah.
Hey, Cornelius Perkins with us. He said, just said to train a client. So I am watching it with a 1-hour delay. So he's, yes. So let's see what else we have here. Do you guys have anything on the stream here? Any questions? What else did we, get? We got the 500 gram one of protein. And maybe they don't have any questions for us.
Yeah,
Casey didn't follow up, or did he? Let's see here.
I'm looking. I'm not seeing anything.
No, he didn't say anything else about it. But he's still with us because he commented about something else. He said that his packaging says to store, and I'm sure he means insulin, 39 degrees Fahrenheit. Before opening. And then store at room temperature after. Okay.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Don't dare put that back in the fridge. Keep it out of the fridge afterwards. Right. Not that it doesn't matter either way, but who knows what that is.
Interesting. It says expired insulin can be donated to certain programs. They give it to people in need in third world countries, for example.
Huh. Oh, that's cool.
IFL USA accepts donations via mail.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. So send your old insulin too.
Yeah. Yeah.
IFL USA.
Let me see if we have anything else here from the stream or from the. I think that was the last one we had on Patreon. In case he never told us what was going on, Michael Devereaux's with us. You should see this guy's gym, Scott. He has like all the nicest machines, like Prime and Arsenal, and he has a whole pole barn set up. It's literally he has a commercial gym set up in this pole barn, out in Indiana, out in the country.
Yeah. I've thought about doing that, and you know, people can see some shots from my gym, from my barn, and I got everything I need there. You know, I mean, it'd be nice to have all those sorts of things, but it's not a problem to just do workarounds, and you know, you kind of get used to it.
Yeah. It's nice to have that stuff when I do go to a gym, but I'm completely content to be able to get everything I need in from home. Then again, though, my expectations of a good workout have changed now as my older years have hit me, because there was a time that I had 3 different gym memberships and I was going here to train legs, there to train back. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Where is it? My gym membership thing. Oh, it's right here somewhere in this pile. See a lot of metal moving. Oh, is that it? Yeah, there it is.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I've kept some of these, you know, just to keep them on here. But this is like, this is over the last decade or so. I don't know how many are on there.
Those are all gym passes, huh?
Those are all gym passes, yeah.
That's funny.
They're not all active, of course, but these are some of these gyms no longer exist.
You'd have to be rich to keep all those gym memberships, especially with today's prices, man. Everything's going up.
I know. Yeah, this is kind of cool to look back on some of these gyms. Good old days. Yes. So I'm trying to think of any other questions.
I think that's about it. We're a good hour in now, so we could call this good.
I have one other thought that.
What's that?
Someone sent me a question. I mentioned to him, I think it'd be okay if I brought this up. I thought he was just kind of joking around. He saw a post from another podcast I had done, and he sent me the question. He says, so progressive overload is not just increasing volume, right? And I said, no, it's not. You know, I thought he was just joking, but he actually had that impression just from consuming probably what the algorithm has brought him. And this idea now, of course, it is one way of progressively overloading, right? But this idea, and I think this comes from Renaissance periodization folks, primarily. And otherwise, is that the way you would progressively overload is by sequentially adding sets to your workout, right? And that's the way you would do that. That is progressive overload. And this notion of adding weight to the bar or getting more reps with the same load wasn't even in his consciousness.
Right.
And And this isn't to cut on him at all. I have no idea. I mean, he may have just started lifting the last year. And the thing that's crazy is you can't blame him for thinking that, right?
If that's the content he's consumed.
That's the content he's brought. And it's interesting that the content would be so presented to him that it wouldn't be contextualized in another way where he would know, you know, that progressive overload can mean various things. Right. Yeah. We talked about the nuances of even like creating oppressive overload by adjusting how you execute your movements.
Yeah.
Right. In terms of speed or mind muscle connection, what have you.
That was a big game changer for me figuring that.
Yeah. I know. That's why I bring it up, because we've talked about it so much. But I thought that absolutely fast. I'm like, wow, I need to at least bring this up on the podcast, because 20 years ago, you know, most people would have thought progressive overload, all that it means is getting stronger or using heavier loads in your training. And now, you know, things kind of go in cycles. Now people are getting the impression that progressive overload doesn't involve that at all, that it's just a matter of adding sets to your workout. And that's how you create a volume overload. I thought that was really fascinating one way I can keep my pulse on, my finger on the pulse of what's going on in the bodybuilding world. I thought that was fascinating. I just wanted to bring that up. You got another question?
Yeah, we had a couple of them here. One that I missed was, and I see Tanya, you just threw one up. But Toned with TJ says, any thoughts on why I get so sleepy immediately after consuming white isolate, even when adding fats, etc.? Always feel immediately sleepy. Is whey super insulinogenic?
Huh. It would likely be less so. So I'm just trying to read that question again. You swiped it. It'd be less so when fats are added. But yeah, it can definitely be. Adding fats. Immediately sleepy. Like immediately.
Yeah, I noticed.
That's interesting.
When I haven't eaten a lot and then I've taken in a whey shake, usually if whey is on its own, I'll tend to go hypo from it. A good hour or so later. And what I've been led to believe is that even though, you know, the protein, we don't think of protein as being something that's going to have like a big insulin spike, but because the nutrients are hitting your bloodstream so rapidly in the form of whey, the body does read that, and the body will release more insulin than, say, if you were to eat, you know, a solid food protein instead, like chicken or something. It's all going to happen at once. And then that whey leaves the body really quick, you know, and my blood sugar's not any higher. It's, yeah, I've noticed I'll start getting cold, clammy, and get like a minor hypo effect from a whey shake.
That definitely, yeah, the amino acids, some of them are more insulinogenic than the others. Mm. But yeah, absolutely. That phenomenon can totally happen without a doubt. It's interesting that when he's doing this, Toned with TJ, could be a woman, I guess, too, but like immediately sleepy. It could be too a psychological thing. If it's like, okay, now I finally got some food in me and I'm no longer hungry. Now I can just kind of relax and take a nap. That can sometimes happen too. If it's that. So yeah, it could, but the hypoglycemia thing, it wouldn't happen as rapidly as what it seems like is happening.
Yeah.
This person. Yeah. Just after taking it in.
Is your family member poisoning you? Is that going on? You know, are you getting dosed with something each time?
Oh, you know, that's happened though. There was a case where a woman was like slowly poisoning her husband or something like that. Ooh. She was putting arsenic in his oatmeal or something. I don't remember what it was, but
yeah. So that probably wouldn't make you sleepy. I just feel like my stomach hurts really bad.
No, you right, know what I mean? It was just getting sicker and sicker.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, and he didn't know why, and like the doctors couldn't figure it out, because who would have thought that he's getting arsenic in his system?
Just a little bit at a time, building up slowly day after day.
Yeah.
Don't forget to eat your oatmeal.
You're evil, man.
Tanya, she says, what's your experience with paradoxin?
I don't have much. It was in one of John's, John Meadows fat burners. It might still be. So it has another stimulatory effect. It doesn't act like a stim, but it has a thermogenic effect.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty expensive.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Grains of Paradise, Paradise Corn Extract. But I haven't tried it out like individually, but it's in one of John's, and there's some research suggesting it can be effective.
Okay.
But my experience is pretty much nothing except for having tried out those just to try it. But I never used John's, all the formulations have since changed. I don't even know if it's still in there, to be honest.
Yeah.
They may have taken that out. They streamlined a lot of stuff.
Okay.
So, but she's, I don't know, like that's probably one that's legal in Germany. So that's probably part of why she's asking because, like for instance, you can't get, hembing is not legal there, for instance.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and, importing stuff is kind of a big no-no. So like I've had people want me to send them supplements from the U.S. and that's kind of, no, you can't do that. You
just can't send. Get yourself like banned from Germany, Scott. You can't have
that. I know. Right. So, I haven't got much experience, but it does seem to work on paper. There's a couple I could send her. Tanya, schick mir eine Nachricht und dann schick ich dir einige, Experimente, einige Papier dazu. So I'll send her some papers.
Nice.
Some studies.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate everybody hanging out with us. This has been a fun way to spend our Sunday morning. And I'm excited for the next episode, Scott. You've got some great insights for us. And I'm going to look forward to that one.
You're a good teaser, man. Nice.
Well, I didn't really tell anybody anything, but you guys are going to want to tune into the next one. Because we have ideas that get brought into bodybuilding and sometimes they're just, people just take it for granted that this is, apparently we never knew it. You've always been doing it wrong. We hear that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You've always been doing it wrong. You didn't know, what you always have done wrong with bodybuilding. And then all of a sudden we just adopt this new idea and we're like, oh, okay. Then I guess this is what we do. This is the mm-hmm. truth. Now we know the truth. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the truth isn't the truth. So I look forward to digging into this next one with you and hearing what you have
there's
to say.
To that point, there's an article I wrote for Elite FDS some years ago. And I think some of this is in my book too, about knowing who to trust. Right. And if you say something, and this isn't, sometimes people aren't intentionally trying to deceive and sometimes they may be to some degree, but the way in which something is said has a tremendous effect on its believability. And I started off that article, I could find this. I don't know if you want to spend the time to do it. I could find this quote that I completely fabricated about the mechanism of muscle contraction.
Yes.
Gerne, Tanya.
Danke. I know that one.
You know that one, right? Let me see if I can... I can find this quote real quick. I think it's here. If it's not here, then we can just let it go. But I wrote this completely facetious. Here it is. I said, what if I were to write? And this is it. Here's the quote. Minerals such as iron, zinc, and trace amounts of boron begin accumulating during embryonic development in the tissues that later differentiate into skeletal muscle. These metals form the basis of the contractile machinery that imbues muscle cells with this force-producing ability. In adult mammals, dietary deficiencies in these elements have been associated with a variety of myopathologies and muscle weakness, whereas iron, zinc, and chromium supplementation produce muscle fiber growth, including hypertrophy and hyperplastic adaptations, even in the absence of external load. And I have three references in there. Smith, J, and Doe, J, Genetic and Dietary Control of Mammalian Embryonic Development, Muscle Tissue, Journal of Significant Results. D's and Balls, Muscle Plasticity, Structural and Mechanical Bases, Archives of Histochemistry. And the last reference is Tate, D, Meadows, J, Starnes, S, Dugdale, M, Sapir, A, Hill, K, S. Superphysiological mineral supplementation induces marine muscle enlargement in microgravity.
Mm-hmm.
Complete nonsense. I made all of that up. Obviously, the references are complete BS.
Sounded real to me.
sounded really impressive, right? Yeah. Just because of, you can concoct really believable bullshit. So anyway, that's a funny article. Don't Just Trust Me is the name of the article.
That's good.
I go into pretty cool stuff. So
that's good. And I look forward to hearing what we talk about next time. So guys, we'll tune back in. Of course, this show comes out every other Sunday at 11 o'clock AM Eastern Standard Time. So we will see you in 2 weeks. Scott, as always, thanks for everything.
Yes, sir, my man. Likewise.